But let's get started. So we're going to study one aspect of Parshat Mishpatim, which is fascinating. This is the famous an eye for an eye Parsha, where the Torah tells us that for certain types of injuries that one is guilty of inflicting on another, that according to the explicit verses in the Torah, that we will punish the guilty party with the same type of injury that they inflicted on somebody else. Now, is anyone aware of you could type this in, or anyone's on the line could mention this? What is the rabbinic view of this verse? Do we take it literally? Do we not take it literally? We'll see if anyone writes in. So the Gemara tells us, and this is somewhat of a well-known understanding of these verses, is that we do not take them literally. Chazal, the rabbis in the Talmud, maintain that the Torah never intended to suggest that physical punishment would be the result of inflicting personal injury. We know that, and we're going to come back to this in a little bit. We do know that there is a notion of capital punishment in Judaism. It is on the books as an option, but that question does play a role in our discussion today. But the rabbis have explicitly said that we will not engage in mandating physical punishment towards others who injure people. So then we are left with the following very difficult quandary, which is why such a great gap between what the Torah says and what the halakha really is. The Torah says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot, a burn for a burn, a wound for a wound, a bruise for a bruise. Why is there such a gap between the words and what the rabbis say is the halakha, which is we figure out the monetary value of the injury, and the injured party is given a settlement, is offered a monetary settlement, but they are not allowed to inflict on the party that injured them any damage, and the Beit Din also is not allowed to inflict on the party any damage. So if that's the case. Why does the Torah, if the Torah doesn't mean to teach that we injure the party, then why does it say we injure the party? And if the Torah does mean we're supposed to injure the party, why do the rabbis come along and say, no, we don't injure the party? The Rambam seemed to have been bothered by this, and he wants to make sure that we don't think this is a rabbinic add-on. He wants to make sure that we understand that the idea of a monetary punishment, of a monetary fine instead of a physical punishment, is the halakha. He wants us to understand that that was the halakha from the get-go. That from the time the halakha was given to Moshe at Har Sinai, from the very, very moment, Moshe understood that it did not mean that there was going to be an eye for an eye, etc. It meant from the very, very beginning that it was going to be monetary punishment. So you see that the Rambam himself wants to make sure that this understanding that it's monetary punishment is not misunderstood. So how are we supposed to understand the gap between what the Torah says and what the halakha is? So one approach to this is to distinguish between, and I first saw this approach in a wonderful book by my childhood rabbi, Rabbi Benjamin Blech, which is called Understanding Judaism, The Basics of Deed and Creed. It's a wonderful book. Rabbi Blech has gone on to write some books about Judaism for, I think, the Idiot's Guide series. But before he did that, he wrote this book. And I first saw this approach there, and I've seen it elsewhere as well. The Torah, says Rabbi Blech, is trying to distinguish between the deserved punishment and the actual punishment. The deserved punishment, says Rabbi Blech and others, is death. The actual punishment is a fine. Why the distinction, however? Why the deserved punishment being one thing, but the actual punishment being another thing? So the rabbis are trying to teach us something very important here. And that is that the respect that the Torah demands for personal integrity, for the ability to go through life without being injured by someone else, the ability to just live your life without fear that you're going to be hurt by someone else, is so supreme, is so important, that the Torah states it as it states other types of capital law cases. That if you violate this right, you are going to be punished as if it were a capital law. Life for a life, limb for a limb, as it were a capital law. However, even though the perpetrator really deserves a physical punishment, the Torah does not or cannot consider physical mutilation as a possible punishment for a crime. Certainly a crime in which the other person was not killed. We'll get to the death penalty in a little while. That was too extreme for the Torah. The Torah wants to roll back that type of barbaric approach, but wants to leave us believing, feeling, the educational goal of the Torah is to leave us feeling that impinging on someone's right to live an uninjured life is so important that the Torah lists it as a halakha of dine nefashot, of capital law. And the reason why the Torah did this is simple, and I think very powerful at the same time. And that is that had the Torah listed it in the books as dine mamonot, as a halakha dealing with a fine, that if you knock someone's eye out, you're going to have to pay a fine. If you hurt someone, you're going to have to pay a fine. Then people would, the same important message as to the gravity of the crime would not have been conveyed. So the Torah conveys the message as if it were a capital law, but punishes as if it is a law dealing, a monetary law, dealing with fines. So the Torah has an educational goal. And Rabbi Blech reminds us that we often forget about this. We often forget about the fact that the Torah is an educational, almost aspirational document. We're trying to get, the Torah is trying to get people from point A to point B. And therefore the Torah will use language which is maybe imprecise and maybe not to be taken literally, because it has an educational goal. And the educational goal is to move people, in this case, from perhaps a society where people do not fully respect the personal, physical integrity of others and their right to live an uninhibited, in terms of being injured by others' life. And so the Torah wants to make that very clear. So it lists it as dine nefashot. In his book, Understanding Judaism, Rabbi Blech offers the following story about the wise men of Chelm. I don't know if any of our viewers or listeners have ever heard of the wise men of Chelm, but they were a group of people who were well known for their sort of backward wisdom, or wisdom that, in Rabbi Blech's words, illustrates the stupidity of mankind when faced with a problem. And here's a great example. The wise men of Chelm were called together because one of the roads in their town had a very steep incline at the point where it veered around the mountainside. There was no protective curb. And so when horses and carriages came barreling down at top speed, unable to make the turn, they hurled down to the bottom of the cliff and were severely injured. So the wise men of Chelm were gathered together to try to figure out how to solve this problem. So Rabbi Blech writes, "What was the city of Chelm to do about this terribly dangerous situation? For 24 hours, they sat and deliberated. A sharp curve, no protective guardrail, people, horses, and carriages constantly falling out, falling off and being hurt. What to do, what to do? And then the answer in a flash of brilliant insight came to them. The city of Chelm agreed in a unanimous vote to build a hospital at the bottom of the cliff. And so this, for Rabbi Blech, sort of explains the problem. The Torah is not trying to deal with the problem after the fact. In this case, it's trying to deal with the problem with the effect, with not with the effects of the problem, but with the cause of the problem. The cause of the problem is that people don't understand the gravity of injuring other people. The wise men of Chelm were not dealing with causes, they were dealing with the effects. The effects of the problem was that people got hurt, so they built a hospital. What they should have done is put up a guardrail or done something to slow people down. So the Torah is trying to put up the guardrail or to slow people down to make sure that they don't injure people. What's their method? They state the violation in such stark terms, almost as to take our breath away and to catch us off guard, to force us to ask, is hurting someone really so bad that we will be physically mutilated ourselves if we do that? Is it really so bad? The Torah says it is so bad that that should be the case, but for other reasons, we are not going to do that. The Torah, says Rabbi Blech, unlike other legal systems, is set up to deal with causes, not with the effects of crimes or not with the effects of mistakes, but, as I said, an aspirational document, an aspirational approach that we're supposed to try to get to a certain point. And so the Torah deals with causes as opposed to dealing with the effects of the problem. There's, of course, another time where the Torah talks about an eye for an eye, and that is in the book of Vayikra. The details are somewhat different, but the approach is the same. I want to touch base on the death penalty issue, because I think that is also related to this, and Rabbi Blech folds it nicely into this notion of the Torah as an aspirational as aspirational document. So we know that in theory, the Torah says that if someone kills someone else, then they will be killed, right? There is a death penalty that exists in the Torah. However, Rabbi Blech points out, as not the only one who has done this, many others have done this as well, that the burden of proof of carrying out the death penalty is so great that it almost never happens. The death penalty is almost so, it's basically impossible to carry out because of the burden of proof that is required. Here are some of the examples. First of all, you need two witnesses, right? Circumstantial evidence is not enough. There's a story in the Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin that illustrates just how far the halacha is willing to go on this question. The Torah talks about Shimon ben Shetach, who swore that he had seen a man chase after another man into a rundown building. Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach ran after him and found his friend dead in the building, and the one who was running after his friend holding a sword dripping with blood. So Shimon ben Shetach said to him, "Wicked one, who killed this man? It is either me or you." "But what can I do?" says Shimon ben Shetach. "Your blood was not given into my hands, because the Torah says, on the basis of two witnesses, shall be put to death." The knife may have been bloody, right? The man is running out of the broken down building. He's the only one who could possibly have committed the murder. But as long as there were not two witnesses who actually saw the crime, the courts cannot condemn the person to death. So circumstantial evidence is not enough. We need two witnesses. And not only do we need two witnesses, but the two witnesses must be kosher, meaning they can't be related to each other. For example, even if Moshe and Aaron themselves witnessed a capital crime, it would be as if the crime never happened, at least from the perspective of the human courts, because they are not fit to serve as witnesses because they are related. The witnesses also have to be free of any of the other disqualifying categories of a witness that the Talmud and the Halakha go into. Besides the exclusion of circumstantial evidence, and besides the requirement of two appropriate witnesses, the Halakha is that the witnesses have to warn the potential perpetrator. No one can be convicted of a crime until they have received proper warning. So what does that mean? It means that two witnesses who see a person about to commit a crime, they have to yell out to the perpetrator the biblical text of the prohibition they are about to break, as well as the punishment. They have to tell them, they have to read them or say to them the verse, as well as the punishment indicated for the crime they're about to commit. So even if there are two witnesses, they have to warn the potential perpetrator in that way. Not only that, the warning is only sufficient if given within a specific interval before the crime is done. Let's say 4 or 5 seconds. What we call in halacha, toch kedei dibor, within speaking time. Like 4 or 5 seconds, the time it would take to say, Shalom Aleichem Rabbi Omori, or Shalom Alecha Rabbi Omori. 4 or 5 seconds. If the people give the warning, the witnesses give the warning, and 4 or 5 seconds pass, and the perpetrator does not commit the crime, and then commits the crime a minute later, it's as if the warning was not given. And then finally, this is a very strange requirement, and that is that the perpetrator has to accept the warning, right? So you have to have two witnesses. They have to be kosher witnesses. They have to warn the person in a specific way. They have to warn the person within a specific interval before the crime is being done. And then the perpetrator has to say, af al pi kein, even though you've warned me, and even though you've told me that the prohibition is so-and-so, and that the penalty is such-and-such, I'm still going to do this. So now, think about it for yourselves. Is it really possible for all of these burdens of proof to be met? Eyewitnesses who are kosher witnesses, who don't have any of the exclusionary marks, if you will, of a non-kosher witness, who warned the perpetrator properly within the amount of time, and the perpetrator has to say, I don't care. So it's no wonder that the Talmud says that maybe once in 70 years, maybe, and some consider that to be too much, maybe once in 70 years the death penalty was given. So what's going on here? If the rabbis are telling us that there are so many hurdles in place of giving the death penalty, why on earth would the Torah tell us of the death penalty at all? It's essentially legislated in our rabbinic tradition out of use. And if that's the case, why would the Torah even talk about the death penalty to begin with? And so here we come back to the answer that I offered before about why the Torah says an eye for an eye, even though it doesn't really mean an eye for an eye. Because the Torah is trying to tell us that murder is a terrible crime, obviously. And someone who perpetrates it deserves to die. We also have to balance that, however, with making sure that we get the right person. But the Torah uses this type of language to remind the reader of what the goal should be. The goal should be a society without murder. How do we create a society without murder? By using language in the Torah that makes it so clear to everyone that murder is the most terrible thing that anyone could do. Again, and it's an aspirational document. Again, it's putting a curb around the mountainside, or it telling people to slow down. It's not about putting a hospital at the bottom of the cliff. If it were about putting a hospital at the bottom of the cliff, we would understand, like the American justice system understands, essentially, that the death penalty is a deterrent. From the perspective of Jewish law, the death penalty is not a deterrent because it's almost never, you're never going to be able to carry it out because of all of the prerequisites that I noted just a moment ago. So it can't be looked at as a deterrent. It has to be looked at more it's not to be looked at as a punishment. It's hopefully be looked at as a way to frame or create a society that wouldn't that would be the situation. We would not be in that case, not be that case to begin with. So the Torah gives us all this language, the language of an eye for an eye, the language of the death penalty, to remind us that of what we're supposed to aspire to, what type of city, what type of not city, what type of society we are supposed to create. It's almost like, this is another example that Rabbi Blech gives, it's almost like when a parent sees a child doing something and they say, if you do that again, I'm going to kill you, right? If you take that if you take that fork and stick it into the socket, I'm going to kill you. A parent doesn't really mean that, but what they're trying to do is use hyperbole to make the case that what the child is doing is so bad or so dangerous that the child would never even think of doing it. So this is a way for us to approach understanding certain aspects of the Torah. We could understand an eye for an eye in that way. We could understand the death penalty in that way. And maybe there are other things also that we could understand in that way. In the sense that even though some of the punishments in the Torah are very hard to really carry out because of technicalities, and even though some of the requirements of the Torah seem very, very difficult to attain, ultimately we have to understand the Torah as an aspirational document. It's trying to create individuals, and through the creation of individuals, create a society that has reached a certain level, a society where that would understand that taking someone's life is completely unacceptable. And even a society that would understand that even injuring someone else, that infringing on someone else's bodily freedom is also unacceptable. And so the Torah uses very strong language to get the point across, even though at the end of the day, other considerations come into play, which lead us to rule practically that we can't carry out the explicit words in the Torah. The end result may be not what the Torah says explicitly, but the end result would be a society and individuals that model the type of life that the Torah is aiming at. And so that helps. That's one approach to understanding the verses in this week's parsha, which have never been understood literally, and why they are stated in such strong language. So that's it for today. Anyone on the phone or online have any questions? Who's on the phone? I know Pablo's on the phone.
It's Reva.
And Reva, hey Reva, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Okay. Anyone? Any of our friends who are logged on want to ask any questions? If not, we'll sign off. We'll just give another 10 seconds just in case there's a bit of a delay. Okay, I don't see any comments, so I wish no questions, thanks, from Marisa Brown. Okay, thank you, Marisa. Okay, I wish everyone a wonderful day, and I hope to see you all soon. And thank you for joining. This was Parshat HaShavua number 3 on our video chat. And I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for learning with me, and I'll see you in shul.